The World Tomorrow. Ambassador College presents Garner Ted Armstrong, bringing you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
Love and marriage just don't mix, the professor says. Love, he said, is a passion, and the literal definition of passion, he continued, is suffering. Now, you may not have realized love is supposed to be suffering, but that's what one psychoanalyst says. Some of the most amazing quotations recently about love and marriage. Remember the song, Love and Marriage, that people sing? Well, something's happening to our marriages. There's not very much love in quite a few of them. And here is the psychoanalyst who said the literal definition of passion, since love, he felt, is a passion, is suffering. It is the tension between desire and fulfillment. He told a whole group of newspaper reporters that as love becomes fulfilled, it ceases to exist. This is why, he said, love and marriage are just plain incompatible. Now, that's about as opposite a statement as you've heard in recent times, but that gained national prominence and, for that matter, was published in other countries recently. It was found that Americans, and I suppose British and South African people maybe believe about the same thing, that love and marriage are essential to each other. Now, you probably thought so. Most people feel that in order to get married, you've got to fall in love. Why people have to fall, maybe we can talk about that a little later, but they call it falling in love. And so it is true that most people believe love and marriage are essential to each other, but this professor said that's the very reason why there are so many divorces. Now, the credentials of the man are that he was born in the Netherlands, he lived in France and Italy, he came to the United States in 1940. He's a psychoanalyst, a sociologist. His specialty is cultural anthropology. He lectures at a university. He's co-author of an outsized book. And he calls, according to his definition, love as necessarily temporary. He also calls it irrational and unpredictable and frenzied. And he says it may make one happy or unhappy, just like many irrational things, such as mountain climbing. On the other hand, the premise of his idea was marriage is very serious. It is rational and legal and quite public. It is, in fact, based on the temporary nature of love and was designed by society to compel people to continue to live together long after their ardor had cooled. Strange words, these, but the stuff of which many people are becoming confused over today. I want you to hear a few of the most fantastic headlines that you've ever heard, perhaps. I don't believe all these headlines, but I thought I would read them to present to you some of the problem that is facing the world today. Not only the American people, but many people around the world, because first of all, you need to realize the basis of all society is the home. That the building blocks of every cultural society is marriage and the home. And today our homes are breaking up. Marriages are being dissolved. Divorce is on the increase. Multiple hundreds of thousands of children living with a second and third, the wife or husband of their father or mother, and for that matter, direct tracing of juvenile delinquency and some of the problems of teenagers and others with mental aberrations and fears being traced to broken homes. For instance, I told you recently in the World Tomorrow program how 10% of the entire age group from 5 to 17 are so suffering with mental problems that psychiatrists feel they need to visit a psychoanalyst and to have actual psychiatric treatment. And many of these problems are being traced to broken homes, to the conditions under which these children must be reared, under which they must grow up. Here are some of the headlines that will raise your hair and shock you a little bit. Here's one that says, adultery can save your marriage. That's right, that's what the headline says. Another one says, premarital sex not always wrong. This was by a bishop in an address to a church. The other one was by a sociologist, a marital counselor. A doctor who is apparently a doctor dealing with childhood diseases says a little adultery won't hurt a happy home. That was another headline. And still another one on how sex outside marriage is not always immoral. That's what a bishop says. And authors of a new book said that they don't see how chastity is any longer a virtue. Now, with all of this hue and cry about how love and marriage don't mix and how everything that people used to think was the very sanctity and the chastity and the security and the stability and the faithfulness upon which a home was put together and upon which it was based, if all of this is out the window, according to these various doctors and sociologists and philosophers, where does that leave us? Today it is true that adultery is rampant and that illegitimacy is on a fantastic increase and that as a result, all kinds of horrible social diseases are continuing to mount. The fantastic drain on the welfare funds of many a state agency, the fantastic problems of education, the fantastic problems of adoption agencies trying to do something with all these hundreds of thousands of children, and the fantastic number of abortions and then of actual child murders that are taking place as a result of it. As a matter of fact, recently it was said that adultery is amazingly common among prominent Americans. A new study in the sex lives of 400 of the nation's business and professional elite had revealed this. It was the result of a five-year research project conducted by Mr. John Cuber and his wife. He's an Ohio State University sociologist and former colleague of Dr. Kinsey, whose report rocked the Western world. All of the people interviewed are of the upper stratum of American life between 35 to 55. All had to be near the top of their professions. Army officers were up, lieutenant colonels or higher. Judges had to sit at the appellate division or above. Doctors had to be leading specialists. Government employees had to be at the $20,000 a year level or higher. And the conclusions of that report are absolutely fantastic, absolutely shocking. He found that marital infidelity was amazingly common among that group, not just teenagers, but people high in business. Well, what is it doing to us? What is the result of it? Some of the statistics about breaking homes and marriages and the result upon the children of those broken homes and marriages are really amazing. What it's doing to the society. Now, it is one of the most vicious cycles that has been set in motion in recent years. It's one of the worst and one of the most deepening sociological problems to this modern age of ours and threatens the very continuance of our modern societies. It's about time you ask yourself, what is marriage? Is marriage really a sort of a natural evolutionary outgrowth of society? Or was marriage invented and designed and planned? If you could go back through history, could you discover who was the very first married couple? And are there any definite laws about marriage that would regulate marriage, that would guarantee marital happiness? Are there any helpful hints in a book that is so absolutely practical, if you can really use it, that would guarantee you would have a happy marriage? Solve your family arguments. Live together in happiness and peace. And that this idea that the sociologists have about marriage becoming a rather humdrum, obnoxious, and monotonous experience needs to be spiced with a little bit of extramarital experience, as they're beginning to say now, how that's absolutely contrary to the laws about a happy marriage. It might surprise you to know the Bible is the greatest book on how to have a happy marriage. It might surprise you to take a look at some of the statistics of people who, regardless as to what you think about their religion, whether you take one group or another group, if you were to take a good long look at those people who have a certain religious fervor or a belief in the practical application of the Bible and find a tremendously low percentage or incidence of divorce among them, you might get a little bit of a clue out of that. If you were to take a look at the happiness in their homes and their children, you'd have to say, well, it's happiness regardless as to what is the method that brings it about. You know, few people seem to realize the Bible is education. That the Bible is a book of education on how to choose a mate, on what marriage is all about, on the individual responsibilities of husbands and wives, that the Bible even deals with the economics of marriage and social responsibilities, that the Bible gives helpful hints on how to keep your marriage happy or how to save a marriage or a home that is about to break up. And that's because people have a certain attitude about the Bible. They have an attitude that it's a sort of a sentimental attack against them, an attempt to get them saved, whatever that means. But they don't seem to realize the Bible is a book that is filled with tremendously necessary education, that it gives the practical, workable, day-to-day solutions to the problems that face everyone. That in the Bible are the answers to the questions and the worries that plague almost everyone's mind. Knowledge you've been looking for and didn't know where to go to get it. Did you know there was a Bible on the late President Kennedy's desk? Now, don't tell some of these groups about that, or you're liable to have some kind of a big Supreme Court suit to find out what Mr. Johnson's doing. It may still be there, on the White House desk, and I wouldn't want to start a national furor in the United States. You know, sometimes people can do nothing more than sue one another about even mentioning the Bible, and especially in a public place, and that may follow in an office of a public official. But I noticed that there's a picture of President Kennedy's desk, and there was a Bible on his desk. So presumably he referred to it and used it. Did you know, for instance, that many lawyers have used the Bible, and particularly some of them have used the Proverbs of Solomon in gathering material for court cases and in advising clients? Did you know many parents have used the Bible, particularly again the book of Proverbs and other sections of the Bible, in rearing and in training their children? Did you know financiers, contractors, even famous athletes have used principles of the Bible on health, on education, principles on diet and physical exercise, principles about financing and taxation and the like, to help them to get ahead and to become successful? Most people don't know that because they have a kind of an automatic reaction against the Bible. They feel the Bible is a sentimental attempt to get them to do something, and they're afraid that maybe if they read the Bible, some strange metamorphosis may take place in their life, and they may find themselves the next moment of their consciousness on a street corner arguing with teenagers and drunks, or maybe passing out soup to tramps on Skid Row, or getting all busy in Christian endeavor, or maybe figuring out the next bingo party or the next house raising, spelled R-A-I-S-I-N-G, supposedly, and maybe getting involved in all the announcements about the bingo party and the bridge club and about this and that kind of an activity that is taking place. And because to many people this is not very exciting, and they can't quite picture themselves in that kind of a way of life, they have a strange suspicion that they'd better stay about as far away from the Bible as they can get. Now, you know, you probably would be amazed to find how many people do use the Bible in a practical, day-by-day sense for the solution to their problems. You may be amazed to find the fantastic and practical instructions in the Bible about marriage. Helpful hints about what a wife can do to make a marriage more pleasant. Helpful hints to a husband about what his attitude ought to be when he comes home from work. Helpful hints to him about what kind of an attitude he ought to have on the job if the boss is a little bit short-tempered today. Oh, sure, the Bible has all kinds of things to say about marriage, because the Bible does reveal to you the origin of marriage. It tells you who invented it. It tells you about the first married couple and shows you their problems, and it's an amazing story to read. The Bible reveals laws about marriage. Now, you and I both know that most marriages have at least part of the Bible quoted in them. And if not, at least there is reference made to a Bible. And many young brides, though they may not be religious, nevertheless walk down the aisle with a Bible in their hands. And people sometimes are asked to place a hand on the Bible, because this book that has been bequeathed to the Western world has had a great deal to do with the development of our society. So why don't you give it a chance and take a look at it for yourself and find out what the Bible has to say. In taking a look at that very first marriage, it is really a fantastic analogy when you realize in modern terminology just what it must have been like to have been Adam and Eve. Now, many people think that Adam and Eve were just purely mythological. They claim they don't believe it. Well, forgetting that for a moment, I'm not arguing that point with you. You can prove that to yourself by proving whether or not there is a God, and by proving whether or not the Bible is true and can be understood or accepted as divinely inspired or believed. And we have a couple of booklets on that subject, Does God Exist and the Proof of the Bible. But in the book of Genesis, right in the very beginning chapters of the Bible, is the story of the very first married couple. And when you think all of the things they had going for them, and then you think of the failure in their married life, it really is quite a story to read. You think of what Adam was like, for example, all of the tremendous things he had that you don't have going for you. He didn't have any background so far as religious prejudices or race difficulties, and he didn't have any conflicting language or accent that his wife might look down on. No mother-in-law around, so he had no problems there. He had no in-laws or relatives or even busybody neighbors to cause strife, so he had no problems there. And he was in perfect physical health and condition, absolutely perfect. Oh, he'd had one operation, but it was rather a minor operation, kind of simply and quickly performed, and there wasn't much of a scar to show for it. He was missing a rib. That's what it says in the book of Genesis. But you know, Adam must have been a real handsome fellow, because he was created by the one who made human beings, and he was in perfect stature, perfect shape, form, and health, and there wasn't much doubt about either one of them, as far as that's concerned, either, because even though I think some people who thought they were living in a sort of a nudist colony, they weren't at all. There wasn't anybody else around. They were in the privacy of their own home in that garden. There wasn't anybody else around at all. Now, look at Adam's economic status. He had an absolutely perfect job. He had plenty of everything he needed. He was the owner of everything he could see. He was in charge of everything, and he knew the boss personally and had a great chance for advancement. He had long talks with the boss. The boss knew him thoroughly, was sympathetic and outgoing, showed a lot of mercy toward him, told him the best way to get ahead, gave him a lot of inside information about the best way to succeed. Now, he didn't have any unions, no strikes, no financial difficulties. He didn't have to pay taxes, although there was one sort of a, you might call, levy on his income. It was demanded of his employer, but that's all right. That was less than most people find consumed in all kinds of outright taxes and hidden taxes anyhow. That was just 10% of his income to his boss, which his boss, who was God, called a tithe. But he didn't have any mental frustrations from overcrowded conditions, and there wasn't anybody around trying to get his job. No one was trying to discredit him before his boss, and no one was trying to win his wife. And there weren't any Tom and Jerry parties and somebody sneaking off into the kitchen with his wife and him wondering what they were talking about. No problem at all. In short, Adam had perfect physical health, a sharp, alert mind, perfect security, and unlimited opportunity for the future. And that's about as much as any young man starting out in marriage could ever begin to ask for. Now, as for Eve, she had about the same thing. She had a beautiful body, a beautiful figure, and a beautiful face. She had a perfect environment in which to live in a lovely home, and it was so completely stocked with food in that garden where they could just take it off the vine or the tree. And it was always fresh, nothing spoiled. And perfect temperature control, so much so that they didn't even need to wear clothes to keep warm. But, you know, something happened to that marriage. So much so that in a short time, Adam lost his job, they lost their home, they began squabbling among themselves, they were reduced from this condition of prosperity and of security to a hard scrabble lot of frustration and of plowing on a little rocky plot to get something to grow, where before they had nothing but plenty. They lived in this air-conditioned garden of nothing but splendor and beauty and little fountains and streams and brooks, and all of a sudden they were out in this wasteland and nothing seemed to work right. Where before they'd had perfect temperature control and climate, now they had nothing but bad weather, and it seemed like even the animals and the insects were against them. In so short a time, they lost their job and their home and entered disillusionment and disappointment. They became even embarrassed and ashamed of each other and had to real quickly start making clothes, because all of a sudden their minds were getting kind of dirty. And they reared the world's first juvenile delinquent and criminal, and lived to see their home torn asunder by murder, a wretched tragedy in their lives and their home, lived to see wretched conditions in the lives of their grandchildren. Now why? What was it that occurred to this perfect beginning? Now even if you think that's a fable, and it's not, and you can prove it to yourself, but it's still a pretty good analogy, isn't it? Even if you think that's a fable, it's about time you looked at the story about the beginning of marriage and asked yourself, well, what happened? You know, my English teacher back in high school wanted me to write a paper on why Hamlet said something. Now, I knew that Hamlet didn't exist, so that kind of made me a little bit short-tempered, because I couldn't see sitting around and trying to reason out in my mind what some fictitious person reasoned out in his mind. But, you know, that's amazing. People study literature, and they try to glean certain lessons for use in life from it. But this is not just literature, and this is not just a fable. This is absolutely true. So you need to find what happened to that marriage. Now you'll find what happened to that marriage right here in the beginning chapters of the book of Genesis, in Genesis 2 and Genesis 3 in the Bible, and it's a good education. on what happened to the very first marriage. Oh, their marriage stuck together, all right. They barely hung on. But they sure didn't have the happiness that they should have had. In the second chapter of the book of Genesis, the Creator, the boss of Adam, had given him a command. He'd said, now look, everything around here that you see is under your control. You're the executive VP. You can handle and you can work with and you can control everything there is, but there's one little bit here that I reserve for myself. That's in the boss's safe, and you don't touch it. That's private and confidential, and that's not for your ears or your eyes. You just leave it alone. You can have everything else, but this one tree of the knowledge of good and evil, you're not to eat of it, for in the day that you do, you are going to surely die. It doesn't mean in that day you'll suffer the death penalty, but it means as sure as you take that, you're going to head right straight toward death, and the only thing that's going to wait for you is just ultimate death. Now, I'm here to announce Adam is dead. Adam has had it. He's dead. So sure enough, that did occur to him. And the Bible claims that death entered because of what Adam did. Now again, you can prove that to yourself. You don't need to think this is a religious argument of some kind. I'm saying the Bible is a book on education. That the Bible also tells you how to live. That it's filled with practical statements about workable laws that work upon you whether you're aware of them or not. And here in the very first marriage is a real good lesson about marriage. Now, Adam just couldn't believe that the boss had that right and that privilege. He just couldn't believe that everything around didn't belong to him. He just had to have something that was not his. He lusted after it. He just had to be as good as his boss, and as long as somebody was around that was giving him an order, he began to resent it. And so when he went home, he got a lot of commiseration. In the meantime, his wife had been talking to this traveling salesman. He had his foot in the door and was giving her all kinds of arguments. You read the story about how the serpent appeared to Eve and said, you're not going to die. God knows better than that. He gives you all these predictions about disaster and calamity going to strike in your life if you disobey. That's not going to happen. He's just trying to withhold something for you. See what he said to her in the third chapter of Genesis in verse 5? For God does know that in the day you eat thereof, then your eyes shall be opened, and you shall be as God is, knowing good and evil. So the woman saw that the tree was good for food. Oh, it was very attractively packaged. It looked real good. It appealed to her sense of sight. It appealed to her sense of competition. She wanted to be as good as God was. And so it was pleasant to the eyes, and a tree to be desired to make one wise. And she sort of felt a little bit inferior to her husband. His mind seemed to be a little sharper than hers, and she wanted to real quickly take this inside course and get to know a lot of things. And amaze him with her ability and her intelligence and her wisdom. So she took of the fruit, she grabbed it real quick, and her husband was this docile type. Whatever wife he did, he went right along with her. She was in a bad attitude, so was he. If she was all up in arms against the boss, well, so was he. If she had an argument about the way things were going, well, he fell right into it, and he comforted her and said, well, that's right, Evie, I really believe that's right. Now, we just ought to have that, and the boss doesn't have any right to keep the secrets of the organization and the corporate plans from us. We ought to have the inside information. And so he took it because she handed it to him, and they both ate of it. And so suddenly they got shame and embarrassment, and they got kicked out and lost their job. He stole the corporation plans and the inside information he wasn't supposed to have, and he got himself canned for it. He got fired. Now, who'd the wife blame? Well, she blamed the traveling salesman. She blamed the serpent. And Adam said it wasn't his fault. His wife did it. So it's just like people are today. You know, they got caught right in the middle of their plans. Here was this conspiracy on the part of the husband and the wife to overthrow the boss, jerk the rug out from under the boss, and take over. He's not going to get away with keeping all this information from us. So here was a home where instead of one member of the family in a loving and a patient manner explaining an outside problem and retaining their integrity together, as strong as the rock of Gibraltar. Now, we're going to have to quit saying that, I'm afraid, one of these days, because Gibraltar is not quite that much of a symbol anymore. But anyhow, so to speak, and instead of saying, I'm sorry, Adam's not here, serpent, can't talk to you, come home when my husband's here. She said, oh, is that right? Well, she was capable of making the decision. Hubby wasn't around, but she could listen to it. She's pretty smart. And especially when he offered her this course and getting a whole lot more brains, she thought, is that right? A tree to make me so wise that I can just have all this knowledge and wisdom? Why? So she just reached out and took it. Gave Adam a good slice of it when he got there. It's an amazing story when you look at it, sort of a modern approach, so to speak. And it's the way a lot of people are living life in their homes today. Instead of being a real solid front against some outside influence, that home was divided. And the wife was using her own capacity for making decisions without counseling with her husband. She wasn't in subjection to her husband, and he wasn't the proper kind of a ruler and leader in love and in respect and understanding and mercy. He wanted to follow her even when he knew she had done the wrong thing. So when they got trapped and called into an accounting for it, boy, did they ever have the excuses. First of all, God said, "Now who told you you were naked?" Well, they got embarrassed, you know. God said, "What'd you do, eat of that tree when I commanded you not to?" Man said, "Well, you see, what happened was," he had this big argument right away, he didn't say, "Well, yes, Lord, I have, and I'm sorry." But he said, "Well, you see, it was a real technical and an intricate and a difficult thing. Now, the problem was, you know this beautiful woman? You know this fantastic creature? You see my scar here from the operation? You know the woman you gave to me? Boy, is she a cagey little thing. Now, she's sweet, and I want you to know that she's cagey, too, though. There's an insidious something in her. And she reasoned around, and really, I was just helpless before her. She wanted me to eat of this thing, and I couldn't. At the point, she started crying when it looked like I wasn't going to." Oh, he had all these arguments. "Wasn't my fault, Lord. She did it." So God said, "Well, woman, what is this that you've done?" The woman said, "Well, now, you see, I'm pretty weak when and a salesman comes around with a spiel like this one had." Now, this guy was handsome, and he had this tremendous talk and spiel. First thing I knew, he had me desiring this. I hardly knew what I was doing. He beguiled me. He tricked me. It isn't me. I didn't do it. The serpent's the one. He tricked me. Isn't that the way of it? So the wife blamed the serpent. Adam blamed his wife. You know, that's the way people are today. They say, "Well, sure, I was wrong, but look how many other people are." So people reason around, "Well, sure, I've been a little bit wrong here, but isn't half the world, doesn't everybody?" I think that's the way some people reason themselves into continuing a smoking habit. They say, "Well, all of us together sort of take our chances together like one big happy family. And sooner or later, if we survive, why, I'll take my chances with the rest of them. I'll probably live on. I won't develop lung cancer." There's kind of comfort in numbers, and that's what these people wanted, comfort in numbers. Well, he did it, sure, but I did it, sure, but then so did he. There are plenty of other good examples I want to give you about marriages, examples about successful marriages and what made them succeed. But what a fantastic world it would be if everybody everywhere obeyed the laws of marriage that are revealed in the Bible, the most practical book on an education for the right marriage that you could ever hope to read. And next time I'll tell you more about it, so keep listening to the World Tomorrow program. Now, in the meantime, write for these articles on how to have a happy marriage. That's what every young person really wants, regardless as to how modern and chic we may feel we are. How to have a happy marriage. And the article on how to solve family arguments. If any of you are quarreling and you're having problems getting along, don't do one thing before you give this article a chance. Read it and find out what it says. How to solve family arguments. And the book that on the plain truth about child rearing tells you a great deal about the principles from the Bible about how to have a happy marriage. And the current number of the Plain Truth magazine with this lead article on President Johnson visits Australia and the Iron Curtain gathering rust. It's free of charge, no price, if you write to Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California. That's Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California. It's free, there is no price, no follow-up, no one's going to call on you. The address again in just a moment. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow. Send your letters to Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California.